from Springfield, this is State Week in Review, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
As you know, I'm here to announce that I no longer will be a candidate for governor. As I've surveyed both the rigors of this campaign and the enormity of the challenges of fixing these problems, I've concluded that I cannot commit to what the voters may need. Until you get in this as a candidate, you don't understand the enormity of not only the campaign and how different it is. It's one thing to be, quite frankly, in the gallery, and it's another thing to be on the dance floor. I've made my opinion of Pat Quinn pretty clear over the last number of months, and I think you've just got to look at the record, and the voters will decide going forward his future.
Well, anybody can say their opinion. I think it's good that we have competition at all times. I know that there'll be an election next year. I know there are four Republican candidates. They're not referring to me as a loving son of a loving mother today or in the future. So we'll have a stern contest, and that's good for the public.
Well, that was Pat Quinn. He got some good news this week. Bill Daley dropping out of the race for governor. That means Quinn appears poised to be the Democratic Party's nominee for governor next spring. And we'll discuss that and more on this week's program. I'm Sean Crawford, news director for WUIS in Springfield. I'm filling in for Bill Wheelhouse this week on State Week. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield, and Brian Mackey, State House reporter for WUIS and Illinois Public Radio. And our guest is Rick Pearson, political editor for the Chicago Tribune and host of the radio show The Sunday Spin, Sunday mornings on WGN Radio in Chicago. Rick joining us from Chicago today. Thanks, Rick, for being with us.
Thank you, Sean.
Well, Rick, I'll start with you. I know that on your show last week, you had a chance to talk with Bill Daley, and he did not give you that scoop that he was dropping out of the race and waited about 24 hours before doing it. Maybe explain what it seemed like talking with him on Sunday and the change to Monday.
Well, in talking to him on Sunday, I mean, basically my first question, because this question has been out there, is, what is the Daley path to victory, was whether a Daley could win statewide office in Illinois. And he was very effusive in his explanation of how he believed that people will judge him for himself based on his resume of two White House administrations, running a presidential campaign for Al Gore, and really explained about he was offended by Pat Quinn's attacks, that here was this guy who was a wealthy banker from his history at J.P. Morgan Chase, and how bankers like Bill Daley were the ones that created the recession. He said, I take a backseat to no one when it comes to my Democratic credentials and values. So there was really, really no inkling during that show that he was going to be dropping out of the race 24 hours later.
Well, of course, he does announce that on Monday. And when you had a chance to speak with him Monday, what was his reaction?
Well, Monday, his first line was, "Well, I thought about telling you on the radio show Sunday, but I didn't think it was a good venue." So his judge of media, even though he's had all this great experience, I guess isn't that good. But when he explained it, and it was kind of evident in that clip where he talks about it's one thing to be in the gallery and another thing on the dance floor, it was this group of inconsistencies. It was, on one hand, I'm not a rookie. I know what I'm getting into by getting into a race. And then on the other hand, saying, well, the enormity of the tasks in front of me, and it's not the campaign, it's if I won, that's a bigger fear than running a campaign. And so you just have these counter statements going on that, in essence, I think, in some respects, reflect kind of a Daley-esque view, given the DNA of the family.
Well, Charlie, let me ask you, do you ever think you'd hear a day where a Daley stood up and said, I didn't realize a campaign could be difficult?
No, but then, on the other hand, I never thought I'd see the day when a Daley attempted to run statewide. The Daley name, for better or for worse, is associated with a lot of maybe myths, maybe truths, in voters outside the city of Chicago, who in central Illinois, for example, the typical attitude towards Chicago is that those are a bunch of freeloaders and they're living off the rest of the state and we should cut off Chicago and put it in Lake Michigan. You get that kind of rhetoric, and Daley epitomizes Chicago, the Daley name. And so he was going to have trouble downstate. Plus, his business background would be a big liability, I think, that Pat Quinn could exploit among people who aren't doing that well after the recession, which a lot of people blame on the excesses of Wall Street and Daley's colleagues at J.P. Morgan Chase and elsewhere. And so there was a lot of baggage there. And even in the city of Chicago, the Daley name doesn't have the luster that it once did, in part because some of the deals that his brother made on his way out the door as mayor, including the whole parking meter fiasco. So it's going to be a very tough race. And it's one thing to be the campaign manager and not really have to deal with members of the public on a daily basis and have to be warm and cuddly and cozy with everybody, even people you think are total idiots, which a candidate has to do. And he just didn't have the stomach for it.
Brian, let me bring you in here because I guess the winner of this, I said this before, but it makes sense that Pat Quinn has apparently been able to withstand this challenge from Bill Daley and won't even make it to the ballot. Good news for Pat Quinn, I guess, going forward.
Yeah, I think Hillary Clinton said it best. She happened to be in Chicago this week for a charity luncheon and said that Quinn has just been entered into the Guinness World Records book as the luckiest politician. And in some ways, that's true, right? I mean, there were a lot of people who thought Pat Quinn, you know, he's a very populist guy. He could very well pull out this primary, but he would have had to spend a lot of money. Daley would have had a lot of money going against him, and it would have left them, you know, either one of them, but especially Quinn, pretty bruised going into the general election next year after the primary. Now he's, earlier this year he was going to face a challenge from Attorney General Lisa Madigan, and she decided not to go forward with that. So now he has a pretty clear path to at least win the primary. He can focus on beating up on the Republicans while they're beating up on each other, and that puts him in a pretty good position next spring.
Well, Bill Daley did some beating up of Pat Quinn even on his way out of this race. Rick, he made a comment there, I guess, saying that Pat Quinn couldn't win. That's certainly not a party unity type of speech.
No, I mean, part of what was interesting, and I think part of what I'm really going to miss here, is kind of the inside-outside nature of this race, where here you've got Pat Quinn, whose history was of being the outsider throwing stones at the glass house of the Democratic insiders, and Bill Daley from, one of the most inside historical families in Illinois politics, playing the outsider. And so when you have Daley talking about defending his Democratic credentials, defending the values of what Democrats should be as public servants, and then on the way out the door says, and by the way, Pat Quinn's going to lose. There's certainly no effort there of trying to close ranks, of trying to be the Democratic soldier that you might expect.
And it occurred to me also that wasn't a very astute political comment, because I don't think it's at all a given that Pat Quinn can't be reelected. And if Daley is serious about it, it calls into judgment or calls into question his judgment of the electorate. Pat Quinn is very much reelectable.
Well, and I agree. And look, we all have seen throughout our history of doing this that at this stage of the game, you can throw out polls, you can throw out everything. So much of events happen that are beyond the control of any one candidate or office holder. But all you have to do is go back to the general election in 2010, where we had a poll, I think it was maybe 5 weeks out of election day, that had Pat Quinn's job approval rating at 28%.
Yeah.
And who won?
Yeah.
Well, Brian, Pat Quinn always gets a bit of a rap of not being And I think he wants this rap of not being a political insider, that maybe sometimes he's not even that politically savvy. But at the same time, I saw him make some moves here over the last couple of months, positioning himself to get the Democratic county chairman backing him, pushing for the slating. And we can talk a little bit about that. That's going to be taking place in Springfield this coming weekend. Moves by Quinn that probably hastened Bill Daley's decision to get out of this race.
Yeah, and I mean, you look at his you know, the actions that he's done tied to governing as well. He vetoing the legislators' paychecks to try and prompt them to do something about pensions was a very politically popular move. He is not, I think, as well regarded within government, though. I mean, you look at the legislators, he does not have a lot of allies in the legislature, people who can bring his legislation and ideas forward. He does not do a lot of negotiating on stuff. He tends to issue these pronouncements or keep things vague until the legislature passes something, like a casino expansion bill, for example, sends it to him, and then he lists what his objections are and vetoes it. And I think there are a lot of people out there who say he is not nearly as good at the mechanism of government as he is at doing the politics.
Well, certainly there's a big question I still have out there, and that was we heard from State Senator Kwame Raoul a few months ago, you know, making moves of whether he would run for governor. It's still a possibility somebody could enter this race, but Rick Pearson, is that very likely at this point that anybody will try to challenge Pat Quinn now?
Well, for a timing basis, it's certainly possible, just because you don't have a candidate petition filing deadline until very early December. And you only need, you know, a minimum of 5,000 signatures to get on the ballot. But beyond that, there's one, you got to have some money, and two, you have to have some credibility. And if you look through the list of potential contenders out there, there aren't a lot of those out there.
Well, we are on State Week, and we will return in just a moment. We'll be talking about a busy week in the courts and state government. And we'll return in just a moment.
Support for State Week in Review comes from the Illinois State Bar Association, whose activities include proposing and shaping legislation, educating the public, and supporting the courts and the rule of law. Information at IllinoisLawyerFinder.com.
And our panel on State Week this week is Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, and Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Rick, you were up in the courts covering one that we talked on just a moment ago, and that was legislative paychecks, the governor vetoing those paychecks, taking them out of the budget because he said they weren't doing enough to get the pension problem solved. It's now in the court system. What did you observe there?
Well, this was the hearing on a lawsuit that was brought by Senate President John Cullerton and House Speaker Michael Madigan, basically challenging on constitutional grounds Quinn's ability to use his line item veto power to zero out legislator paychecks for the current new fiscal year until there is some kind of solution on pensions, if and when. And, I mean, you had some very highly technical arguments here, things like the fact that in the Constitution it's expressly prohibited that changes be made in the salaries of legislators during their term, and whether the word changes means increases, as the governor's lawyers argued, or whether changes mean increases or decreases, as the lawyers for the two Democratic legislative leaders argued. Also such things as questioning whether, while the governor using his line item veto authority, zeroing out those legislative salaries, while he did it according to historical form, whether the bill itself still allowed for salary and checks to be issued because it didn't zero out the entire lump sum that had been appropriated. So you had about 2 hours of questioning over that, but you also had some very interesting questions raised by Judge Neil Cohen, who's hearing the suit. He says that he will have a decision by Thursday in this case, but one where he basically asked lawyers for Judy Bartopinka, and these were lawyers from Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan's office representing the comptroller, why didn't Judy Topinka just issue the paychecks that his reading, the judge's reading of the Constitution was that a line item veto is not final action until the General Assembly has a chance to consider it. And there was some very vehement questioning by the judge here on if Judy Topinka had just written those checks, we wouldn't have a case in front of us today.
Well, Topinka has certainly been dragged into this, Charlie.
Well, the difficulty is that it's pretty clear in the law and the plain language of the Constitution. When Quinn line-itemed out the appropriation to pay the salaries, there was no legal authority to spend that money. So Topinka could not have done that without violating the law. And the way it works on a line-item veto, when the governor acts on an appropriation bill and strikes out portions of it, everything that he hasn't stricken becomes law. What he's stricken is gone unless the legislature chooses to restore it, to override the veto at some future date. And it's an important thing because this particular bill that included the legislative salaries also included money for the judicial branch, money for the executive officers, money for dozens of large state agencies. It was a 250-page bill, and Quinn struck a couple of paragraphs out of that 250 pages. When he issued his veto, all the rest of those 250 pages became law, authorized the comptroller to spend money for all of those thousands and thousands of purposes, but her authority to issue paychecks to lawmakers does not exist unless and until the General Assembly comes back and by three-fifths majorities overrides that particular line item veto.
Well, is Quinn winning this fight, I mean, in the public's view, or is anybody paying really close attention of whether or not do they care that lawmakers get paid or not?
I suspect that on a purely political basis, he's doing really well. Yeah, it's really popular. I personally think that as a matter of governance and as a matter of proper functioning of the government, it's probably the most reprehensible thing I've seen in 40 years, and totally irresponsible. You start down on a path where suddenly it's tit for tat. Supposing the General Assembly decides next year not to provide any money for the governor's office. I mean, it's crazy. But on the other hand, it's intensely popular among people, the general public, because you alluded earlier to Quinn's prior low approval rating. His approval rating is still pretty low, but he still ranks ahead of the General Assembly as an institution.
And I think it's important to keep in mind here that this is, I mean, what I think the Senate President and House Speaker have said they're concerned about is how this could be used in the future. Let's imagine, you know, a few years from now, we have a Republican governor who wants to put in, a Texas-style restrictive anti-abortion bill. And he says, well, I'm going to withhold your salaries until we get that passed. Or, maybe roll back civil unions or something like that with a very conservative. Or you could have a very liberal governor who wants to do something else in the future. And I think that the lawmakers are just concerned that this is not the proper balance of powers. You know, Governor Quinn is fond of saying in this pension debate, we're always saying, why aren't you proposing your own solutions? Reporters are asking them. So why aren't you negotiating more and getting more involved in the minutia of coming up with a solution? And he says, well, it's the legislature's job to pass the bills and I sign them. And he's even said the phrase, I don't want to tell them what to do. I don't think it's a good idea. But that's exactly what he is trying to do here. I'm not a lawyer, but I think you could make a case that he's almost extorting them to pass some sort of pension legislation.
Well, there's no doubt that the argument being raised by the two Democratic legislative leaders very much also focused on this issue of coercion and whether this was a overreach by the executive branch into the functions and the authority of the legislative branch. But politically, regardless of the outcome of the case, I think Quinn comes out a winner here because were the courts to rule that his actions were unconstitutional, it doesn't stop Pat Quinn from running commercials saying, I'm the guy who tried to do this, who took the money away from the salaries. And, let's remember there's a history here, too, of Pat Quinn and the General Assembly, the whole salary issue that he readily touts about his efforts that led to legislators not collecting their paychecks in advance and ending that practice.
And, of course, Quinn did something similar with the regional superintendents of schools just a couple of years ago, where he knocked out their salaries for quite a number of months, actually. And so it's not something that he hasn't delved into his bag of tricks for before. But, Brian, let me move to you now, because you also covered another court case this week, this one before the Illinois Supreme Court. Fill us in about that.
Yeah, this is a case. Illinois has not, as we've just been saying, has not been able to come up with any legislation that solves the $100 billion in future pension liabilities. But they did pass a law last year that's going to start making state retirees pay for their health insurance. For a long time now, Illinois has paid for, as long as you have 20 years of service in the state, once you retire, they would pay 100% of your health insurance premiums. Well, beginning this July, retirees have had to pay 1% of their check if they are eligible for Medicare, and 2% if they're not. That's going to double next year. That money is being set aside because it's being collected, but it's set aside in a special account because there's a lawsuit that's been brought challenging this practice. The basic argument here is that the Illinois Constitution says membership in a pension system is a contractual right, the benefits of which shall not be diminished. And the legal question that the Illinois Supreme Court was considering in arguments this week up in Chicago is, does that the word benefit in the Constitution, in this pension protection clause in the Constitution, does it include health insurance for retirees?
It seems as though before any legislation would be passed, to some extent, that this issue almost needs to be resolved. Or am I thinking too far ahead on this?
Well, the legislation has been passed, and as Brian said, the question is what is the benefit? And there's the further question.
Just to clarify that, I meant future legislation on something with pensions,
like pension legislation.
Yeah,
This could be a real tip off. For example, if the court says the pension protection clause in the Constitution says you can't change health insurance, then for sure you can't go in and take away benefits from retired school teachers. On the other hand, there's a question that goes beyond the Illinois Constitution, and that gets to, is this a contractual relationship? Because under federal constitution, you can't arbitrarily abrogate contracts either, and the retirees are arguing that we have a contract with the state. We were told that you take this job, you work for 20 years, and you won't have to pay premiums for your health insurance in retirement. That was part of the deal. So it's a contract between us and the state as an employer. Now the state comes back and says, we're not going to live up to the terms of our contract. And the retirees argue you can't unilaterally change the terms of a contract going to the highest level under the federal constitution.
Right. And Charlie, and I think you've just hit what the bigger picture in all of this is, what, as it applies to what and if the General Assembly does something about the public employee pension unfunded liability, is that whole federal constitutional issue. A lot of people keep pointing at the fact that, well, if the legislature does anything, it's going to go to the courts. Well, it's not just the Illinois courts. It also is a ripe issue for a federal court, too. So it's a process that could take a long, long time. And at the same time, none of that is helping to do anything to diminish the unfunded pension liability.
And we should maybe just say why they're decided to do this to retirees. This is, I guess, there's the state is spending, I think the number that was thrown out around last year was $800 million a year. It came up in the arguments at the Supreme Court this week that it costs the state about $5,000 a year for retiree health insurance. For that benefit. On the other hand, I've talked to retirees who are saying, and the state made this argument, yes, it's only 1%, 2% now, but if the court, and this actually came up in questioning Justice Robert Thomas, and we should note that all the members of the court are also members of the judges' retirement system of Illinois and would be subject to paying this additional health insurance premium fee once they decide to retire. But he said, if we rule in your favor, is there anything to stop the state in the future from just eliminating health care for retirees altogether? And the state said, constitutionally, no, there's nothing that would stop us from doing that.
So we don't know. That was just oral arguments. It'll be sometime next year, possibly, before we hear the final decision on that one.
Well, I mean, the courts take as much as a year, although this one has moved very quickly. It skipped over the usual appellate court process. It went straight from a judge here in Springfield all the way up to the Supreme Court in just a matter of months. So it does seem to be on somewhat of a faster track.
Well, Al, just about a minute or so here for anybody that wants to weigh in on Bill Brady's pick for lieutenant governor. He went with a suburban, former suburban mayor and a woman to take that position.
Well, real quickly, Brady this go round of running has not said anything critical about his last running mate, Jason Plummer from southwestern Illinois, but he has noted one of the things that's different this time is that in getting to pick your own running mate, he was actively seeking to achieve some kind of geographic balance, and there was very little appeal to the suburbs in Brady's candidacy last time.
And Maria Rodriguez is a former mayor of Long Grove and also ran in the primary, I guess, against Joe Walsh, but lost. You probably covered that.
Yeah, and she finished in third in that primary. But Brady is, even though she says that she's very supportive of Brady's positions, social conservative positions, the Brady camp is looking to her to do some of the outreach with suburban women, even though, as our polling has shown, suburban Republican women tend to be more socially moderate.
Time now for our notes from the field. Charlie, I'll start with you.
All right. Well, as I regularly do, I have an update on the Illinois video gaming. The Illinois Gaming Board reported a few days ago that the number of video gaming terminals is now 9,400 and change across the state. That's about 600 more than it was a month prior. Gamblers have played some $2.3 billion, and they've won about $2.1 billion. The state has taken in almost $38 million. Local governments have taken in $9 million. So it just chugs along, and there's apparently money for people who win. There's money for the state. And there's money for local governments, so everything's copacetic.
Everything's going well, I guess, with that. And then we move on to Rick Pearson.
Well, my note from the field goes back to the hearing over the legislative paychecks. I was frankly struck by when you have this high hourly paid group of lawyers in a room, the misunderstandings about government ranging from the judge and his interpretation of what a veto is to the lead lawyer for the two Democratic legislative leaders who, when asked about, well, if the legislature just overrode the governor's veto, there wouldn't be a case, and the lawyer kept referring to the two-thirds support you need to override a gubernatorial veto when it's three-fifths. And since this is a case about constitutional law, I would think you would know what the Constitution requires.
Brian Mackey.
So running against Lisa Madigan is never easy. She's beaten each of her last two opponents by more than a million votes, but there is a Republican who is stepping up to the challenge. He's a retired Marine Corps attorney, Paul Schimpf. He lives in Waterloo, Illinois. He has a pretty interesting career. He was deployed to Iraq, advised the Iraqi prosecutors who were going after Saddam Hussein during that conflict. He says that he would like to see the Attorney General's office more focused on anti-corruption issues, acknowledges it'll be an uphill climb, but there is a Republican who's going to take on Lisa Madigan.
And that's all the time we have for this edition of State Week. Thanks to Rick Pearson, the WGN radio host and political writer for the Chicago Tribune. You can get a podcast of this show by going to WUIS.org, or if using a desktop or laptop, find it on iTunes. Just search for State Week in Review. The production assistance for our program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week in Review, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week in Review is produced in the state capitol by public radio station WUIS. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.